Hello, it's Friday, November 29th. This is The Attitude. Arnie Arneson can't be with us today. I'm Ken Barnes. I'll be your host for today's show, and I'll be replaying one of my favorite interviews. It's with Eric Holder, the former Attorney General of the United States. We recorded on June 25th, 2019. We were indeed fortunate to have had Attorney General Holder right here in our basement studios. He had a lot of impressive things to say, and I guarantee that you're going to enjoy listening to this.
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. We have had the absolute luck to have the former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder in our state of New Hampshire. He is here to talk about redistricting, something that is very passionate for me. My producer, Ken Barnes, is sitting here as well as we tape this show. And we are more than pleased to have him come and talk about an issue we think is crucial for the democracy. It's not about redistricting. It's about how we elect our future officials and whether there'll be balance and fairness. No. So, Eric Holder, former Attorney General, welcome to WNHN-FM in the basement of the IBEW building, and we're pleased to have you.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Arnie. Thank you so much. It's for your listeners, you should know this is a very lavish studio that we're in right now. It's really tremendous.
Thank you so much.
How do you like the view?
It's beautiful. You can see the mountains here and everything.
Oh, that's right. Great. He's looking at a picture of the mountain.
I'm looking at a picture of mountains, so everybody should know.
So, but to give you an idea of what an eclectic station we are, this morning we also taped another show, but it was with a former New Hampshire Attorney General, Assistant Attorney General, and I mentioned that you were coming. And he said to me, Arnie, do you know that California hired Eric Holder as their, quote, this is the headline from the New York Times, their legal bulwark against the Donald Trump administration. Are you still on retainer?
Yeah, we still have a relationship with California, though it's interesting. The California legislature prepared itself for an onslaught of action by the Trump administration that would undo all the progressive things that they had done there. And yet there's been a lot of bluster. There's been a lot of conversation. But in terms of actually doing things that would have an impact on California itself, there has not been really a substantial amount.
Well, but that's because they knew they'd have to face you.
Exactly.
Come on. You
know, a real lawyer from the Justice Department.
Exactly. Well, we will get into Attorney General Barr, but we have to start with the real raison d'etre for your being here.
And California has sued the government a number of times. Mm-hmm. Are you involved with those, or is that the AG?
No, that's the AG. I mean, Javier Becerra is a great AG, and he has been, I think, appropriately aggressive and has brought a number of suits on behalf of the citizens of the state.
Right.
This is so exciting. All right. So I saw a piece in the Concord Monitor, and you and Arnold Schwarzenegger, named after me, I'm sure, Arnie, was entitled Redistricting Reform Gives Power Back to the People. You are here to talk about redistricting. You're also here because the Democratic National Committee is really seeing this as an important issue, both for the Democratic Party and, let's be honest, it is for the country. So tell me what it is you're here to do and what kind of information you want to provide to an audience that they either, one, don't already know or haven't connected the dots to realize they care about this issue.
Well, I'd start kind of what I consider the most important point. The National Democratic Redistricting Committee that I am the chair of is designed to make sure that in 2021 we have a fair redistricting process. This means, from my perspective, that we will enhance our democracy. We will have elections that are probably more competitive. We will end up with governments both at the state level and at the federal level that are more representative of the desires of the people. We hope to do away with these irregularly, inappropriately drawn districts that make it
look
almost
like amoebas, you mean?
Look like amoebas. I mean, in Virginia, they had a district that was only contiguous when the James River was at high tide. And so these are the kinds of things that we are trying to fight. Or places like in Wisconsin where Democrats get about 50% of the vote, get about 25% of the seats in the state legislature. And you see the same thing repeated in Michigan, in Ohio, North Carolina, Texas, Florida. So we are trying to bring fairness to the system. This is not, I want to really emphasize, this is not an attempt to gerrymander for Democrats. We want to make sure that the process is fair. But I think if we have a fair process, the Democrats and progressives will do just fine.
Excuse me. Can you elaborate for the listeners on this concept of how one party, in this case the Democrats, can win 50%, let's say, of the votes, but only get 25% of the seats? Because I think that's really the key problem that gerrymandering makes possible. And I think just saying that it happens doesn't tell people how it happens.
Yeah, there's an art to drawing district lines. And you can, there's two things you can do. It's called cracking and packing. You can crack up communities of interest, Democrats, for instance, or if you do racial gerrymandering, African Americans, for instance, and spread them out in such a way that you decrease their power. Or you can pack them. Pack all the Democrats, all the African Americans into one district and therefore have the ability for Republicans to have greater power in all the other districts. And so there's a variety of ways in which it's done. It's been something that we've had in the Republic almost as long as it has been in existence, but it doesn't mean that we need to accept it. Now, I think, is a time for us to finally say we're going to put an end to this practice and we're going to come up with a system that is more fair. If you do that, you will have more competitive elections. You'll have people who represent the desires of the people. It will mean that governments will work better. It will mean that we will do away with a lot of the hyper-partisanship that we see. Because when you have gerrymandered districts, you're not worried about a general election. You're worried about a primary. And so that drives you further and further to the right, further and further to the left.
And so I have to ask this, Eric, because, you know, winning is important. And time to win when you're talking about redistricting is right after the census. Mm-hmm. And I think the Democrats were asleep at the switch last time
in
around.
2011.
And
yep.
Exactly. And so what you saw was Republicans taking control of state legislatures all over the country, taking control of governor seats. And, of course, when the Republicans took control, they then obviously had the power of the pen to actually define those districts. And they defined them in such a way that we do see the example in places like Wisconsin where you can, you know, have so many votes but then only earn in so many districts. Now you have to convince people that that will change and that if Democrats win state legislatures, this is a state legislature conversation, mm-hmm. everyone. This is not a national conversation. It's a conversation that's different in Alabama than it is in California, that they will not do what Republicans did after the 2010 census, and that part of the reason why you want them is not because winning as Democrats is a good thing. It's that there is a commitment to fairness. And that, I think, is so important. And frankly, I want Republicans to listen to this because it's good for you. It's good for you. This is not good for Democrats or progressives. This is good for Republicans as well because it offers them a true shot at winning an election and not actually losing at the primary level where thoughtful Republicans never quite get through the process.
Right. I mean, I would not lend my name to an effort that was designed to, in essence, cheat. And that's what gerrymandering is. It's cheating.
It's cheating.
To cheat in a way that so many have done in the past. President Obama has identified this as his principal political involvement in his post-presidency. And he would not lend his name to an effort to gerrymander on behalf of Democrats. This is democracy enhancing. It's democracy promoting. It's about fairness. It's about having, you know, more contested elections, you know, and let's make this a battle of policies and philosophies and ideas as opposed to who can draw maps the most creatively.
Well, what do they say? They say that what happens is politicians actually pick their voters.
Well, exactly.
And that's not democracy. That's democracy has been flipped out. Let's also remind everyone, I think, that it is an urgency to this now. And I think, I mean, I've been talking to a lot of presidential candidates, and I keep saying there are three things that we have to focus on. And we have to focus on recognizing people's fears are legitimate. Mm-hmm. We have to recognize the urgency of the moment. And then we have to have a hopeful vision for the future. And that's true for a presidential candidate. But on the gerrymandering thing, it's also true because there is an urgency now because the sophistication that you can get now in defining districts is a million times different than it was a decade ago, and that's a bad thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, gerrymandering, as I said, has been around for a long time.
Yes.
But if you couple the desire to gerrymander with the technological capabilities that we now have, mm-hmm. you end up with really, really amazing results. I was at North Carolina A&T, historically black college in North Carolina. If you're in one dorm, same street, if you're in one dorm, you are in one district. If you go across this street, and it's not a huge – wide street. You go across the street, the kids in the other dorm are in a different district. The desire there was to crack, to make sure that this African-American enclave
yes, exactly.
would be in different districts and decrease the power of African-Americans to vote for state legislators in North Carolina. And so they ended up drawing a line right through the campus.
So you've gone around the country. You've become sophisticated on this issue. And obviously, I embrace it as well. What kind of examples can we give people to have them understand? Is there one way to God, or is there many ways to God, in the sense that should we have a separate independent council? Should we just take out a ruler and divide the state into 12 places? What works, and what are the things that you think might work better than others so that we can have an informed conversation, but that the result we get is the one that truly is the most representative of the communities. And communities of interest, to me, always aren't about cracking and fracking or whatever you're doing with it. But it's really, when you look at a geography map, you want people who live by the same river, they go to the same schools, they shop at the same stores. And that, to me, you can sort of see it from above and say, well, this is a natural break, not based on color or race, but based on how people live their lives.
Well, Arnie, you've actually gone through pretty concisely the factors that I think go into a fair redistricting process. You want to have districts that are relatively compact. You want to have them contiguous.
Yes.
You want to have them encompass communities of interest. And you also want to be respecters of natural boundaries. If you use those four factors, you can pretty much draw, fair district lines. I mean, you had one in Pennsylvania that was called Donald Duck Kicking Goofy. Two stick figures only joined by Donald Duck's boot going into Goofy's rear end. And that was drawn specifically so that a Republican would be able to, win in that district. Before, Pennsylvania is about a 50-50 state, slightly more Democrats than Republicans. And you've looked at the congressional delegation before we filed a lawsuit that we won. The congressional delegation was 13 Republicans, 5 Democrats. After the lawsuit, there are now 9 Republicans and 9 Democrats. And so that's what we are trying to do. Create districts that are fair, and it doesn't mean that Democrats now control the Pennsylvania congressional delegation, but it does mean that Democrats are adequately represented. And I think, the best test from my perspective is that one of the things, I think the best way to do it is what you're now considering here in New Hampshire, the creation of these independent commissions. Take it out of the hands of politicians altogether. My Republican counterparts who are trying to say that they're also involved in a fair redistricting process, stand for that. Say that you will, take the power away from your politicians, put them in the hands of these nonpartisan commissions and have the lines drawn that way, as they do in California, as they do in Arizona, and as they're going to be doing in 4 other states that just passed measures in 2018. I did an event with Arnold Schwarzenegger in Washington about 4 weeks or so ago, and he, former governor, is very supportive of this idea of the creation of the independent commissions, and he and I did an event together, and he and I wrote that piece for you up here in New Hampshire.
Could I follow up, and this relates to what you just said, but also to circling back to Arnie's point about Republicans should support this too because they stand to benefit. Here in New Hampshire, well, I'm on the board of Open Democracy, which is a group that has in fact lobbied and helped write the New Hampshire bill for an independent redistricting commission. And one of the important factors on which we talked to Republicans as well as Democrats was, hey, look, this is the year before the census. We don't know what the data is going to look like. This is a year when Democrats are in control of both houses of our legislature. And if the Democrats win seats in next year's election, they'll be in control again, and they would be redrawing the district lines. And so let's all agree before any of that happens, before anybody's ox is really about to get gored, let's agree that we're going to do this by a fair method. And you know what? We had 100% unanimous support in the House committee that voted for this independent commission bill. All the Republicans, as well as all the Democrats, voted for it.
Well, you know, but I think what's so interesting here, though, is that I'm looking at what's happening under Trump. And I'm thinking about the Republican Party that I got elected in 1984, Eric. And do you know who asked me to run for the New Hampshire legislature? The Republican majority leader. No, no, I'm one of the most liberal people in my state to this date, okay? And you know what? He saw me operating in the Constitutional Convention, which was a citizen participation, not a partisan one. And at the end of the 6 weeks, he came up to me and said, I think you need to run, Arnie, for the legislature. And I was like totally shocked. I said, first of all, I was pregnant. But second of all, I looked at him and I said, Bruce, I think I'm a Democrat. I think I'm a liberal Democrat. And I've told this story 100 times. And he said, Arnie, we could tell. And then I said, so what are you asking? And this is the power of what you're talking about. He said, 75% of what we do in the New Hampshire legislature is about what's good for New Hampshire, and 25% of it is partisan. I need to think that you should be there for the 75%. Yeah. I adored that man. We didn't agree, but I adored him. Yes, I ran. Yes, I won. 8 years later, I ran for governor, and they said, what have you done? But at the same time, but what he saw was an intellect, someone who would listen, someone who would be thoughtful, someone who could contribute to the conversation. And to a large extent, dealing with this gerrymandering thing is actually dealing with it on a structural level, so that great minds and good minds on both sides of the aisle can percolate through the system, so voters get a real choice.
Yeah.
And that story of Bruce Rounds and Arnie Arneson back in 1984 is really the beginning of this conversation that we're now having in 2019. And I am so grateful for what he did. Mm-hmm. But think about it. It was a Republican that saw me in action and said, you're smart. You should consider running. Not that I can promise you'll win, but you should think about running.
But his observation, I think, is really important, that you know, the majority of things that you're going to consider as a state legislator are not going to be purely political. And that's why I think when people hear about gerrymandering, they hear about redistricting, maybe their eyes glaze over. And I say, well, wait a minute. If you care about health care, if you care about gun violence prevention, if you care about climate change, voting rights, if you care about, you know, protecting women's reproductive rights, those are all issues that are decided in state legislatures.
Yes.
And if you have gerrymandered state legislatures, you're going to have the special interests that are going to be represented to a far greater degree than the people, you know? And
you have proof of it. The proof? I was on Fox News a couple weeks ago, and we were talking about the increase in the minimum wage. And the increase in the minimum wage, ladies and gentlemen, has increased in every single state it has been on in a referendum, which meant it's a statewide vote, not a vote in the legislature. Whether it's a red state or a blue state, it has passed. That's despite the fact that in the red states, every legislator is saying, no, 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 we can't do it. The governor is saying, no, no, we can't do it. But when the question is asked of the people, they say yes. What does that tell you about the lack of representation they have on issues that aren't on a referendum basis?
Well, it's also consistent with what we have found as we have tried to push this notion of independent commissions. Wherever we've been able to get it on the ballot and just allow it to be voted on by the citizens, it passes overwhelmingly in places as disparate as Utah, Missouri, Michigan, Colorado.
Right.
Now, red states, blue states, purple states all say, you know what? So we'll have this done by an independent commission instead of having politicians picking their voters. We'll go for the commissions.
Okay. All right. Now I got to ask nitty gritty. Here I am. What does an independent commission look like? What would be a good independent commission? Because I'm always afraid that, you know, just because you say it's an independent commission, there are ways to manipulate the system so that the outcome, you know, sounds independent, but the result is so not independent. Someone else has been pulling the strings.
Right.
So if you were God for a day and you had to sort of create the best concept of an independent commission, Attorney General Eric Holder, what would that look like?
I'm God now.
You're God now. I'm just elevated.
I'm not sure I want all that power.
One day, promise you.
give me 48 hours and I could do all kinds of interesting things. No, but I'd say that these the ones that work, I think, well, look different state by state.
Yes,
California is different than Arizona. The system that you're now considering here in New Hampshire, I think, is a pretty good one. You know, you'll end up with 5 Democrats, 5 Republicans, and they will then pick 5 non-affiliated people. And I think that makes a great deal of sense. You know, there are other ways in which it is done. I think the main thing is just to make sure I think you should have political representation. You should have partisans on the commission to protect party interests. Because that's fine. But you should have a sufficient—
They keep each other honest.
Yeah. But you should have a sufficient number of independents such that, you know, the Republicans can't run the table, the Democrats can't run the table, that in essence it's going to be the power of the independent bloc that will ultimately decide. And as I said, I think the thing that has been passed in the New Hampshire legislature is a good way to do it. And now it'll be up to the governor to hopefully sign it.
Well, you know, I say over and over again that in a lot of ways this kind of fair redistricting is the best savior for the Republican Party. I mean, this is they need this more in some ways than we do. Well, and I'm not quite sure that they're aware of that because I think it's important.
I think that's a really good point because the reality is unless we get into fair redistricting that potentially will make them change some of the policies that they espouse, they will end up being a minority party trying to exercise majority power. Yes. And they have shown a degree of comfort with that, but that is not something that will allow the party to endure over the long term.
So I was at a grocery store about 20 minutes ago, and there was a gentleman in front of me who recognized me, and so he started talking about Pocahontas and Bernie and all that stuff. And I let him talk, and I just sort of let him walk through. And then the guy at the counter who was checking me out said, "So are you a liberal?" I said, "Yeah." I said, I could sort of tell by the guy in front of him. And he said, "So let me just be honest with you, Arnie." And he's a checkout guy, okay? Mm-hmm. He said, "I don't care. I don't care if he's gay. Right. I don't care if he's black. I don't care if he's old. I don't care if he's young. I just need to work at some place other than Aldi's for the rest of my life. And I need to know that I can make more than $15 an hour. And Aldi's plays a good – because we have very, very low unemployment. But he said, but I got to care for a family." Mm-hmm. And he said, "So whoever we get, I just hope it's different." Mm-hmm. And it was like so funny because here he saw these sort of two competing voices, and that's what he wanted me to know. It's not a partisan issue. It's see me. You know, address
and
me.
That's where the American people are. They want government to work for them. And, you know, Ronald Reagan famously said that in his inaugural address in 1980 that the problem is government. I think the reality is that, you know, Bill Clinton also said that, you know, the era of big government is over. I think here's the deal. Maybe the era of big government is over, but the need for good government endures.
Oh, my God. I'm sending you the last half hour of our conversation on the radio.
We talked about that exactly those words.
Exactly the same thing. Mm-hmm. And you know what I use as an example? Just think about this because people don't realize this. I use the example of the federal government used to send us 90% of the cost of a sewage treatment plant, and you would have to come up with 10%. Mm-hmm. What did that mean? You could bring in manufacturing. Your city could expand. Your state could improve. And then they flipped it. Basically. I said, what do you think that was? What we have today is bad government. What that 90% was good government because it didn't care what state you were in. It didn't care what city or town. If you were willing to consider this, they were willing to support you.
Well, think about the Affordable Care Act. You know, we're going to – if you expand Medicaid in your state, federal government will pay for 90% of that, as you said. Mm-hmm. State has to kick in 10%. And guess what? It'll promote better health results for the citizens in your state. And yet, for ideological reasons, gerrymandering reasons, in certain states, Republicans say, no, we don't want to do that, in spite of the fact that the people want that to occur. That's the power of gerrymandering.
Well, but actually, it's Ronald Reagan. I mean, I remember Ronald Reagan saying he didn't like welfare, but he valued work. And one of the things that's brilliant about the expansion of Medicaid is for working people. Yeah. It is for working people. It is a Ronald Reagan program, you know, just like the Earned Income Tax Credit, a Ronald Reagan program. Right. And I think in some ways, and that's why when I go into these Republican communities and I see that they have not embraced the expansion of Medicaid, I said, do you get it? You know, it's about recognizing the value of work, and you have. Now, when you get sick, should you be able to go to a doctor?
Well, I mean, it's the same thing, again, with the Affordable Care Act, something that, you know, obviously was tinkered with and modified by President Obama, but has as its origin something that Mitt Romney did in Massachusetts, and yet Republicans thought that this was the second coming of Satan or something, you know, and they had to oppose it at all costs, demonized it, you know, talked about death panels and all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. You talk to President Obama, and what he has said is that it's going to be always called Obamacare until it becomes popular, and then it'll start to be called the Affordable Care Act. And you see that now. It's now everybody calls it the ACA because people like it. You know, they've seen the results of it. They've seen, you know, you get to keep your kid on your insurance policy at 26. People with pre-existing conditions are protected. People like it. People base, you know, there's a degree of comfort, you know, that you're not going to go bankrupt. You're not going to lose, you know, your house. You're not going to lose a relative because you don't have medical care.
So the beauty of the – let me tell you the other beauty of the ACA is it finally liberated a lot of us who lived tragedies to be able to say how the ACA kept that from happening. When I was running for governor, we lost our health insurance because our economy was so bad, and my husband had to choose between paying the property taxes or paying the health insurance. Mm-hmm. And the property tax bill was a public knowledge. That my health care bill – guess who found a lump in her breast while she's running? Mm-hmm. But what did that mean? I would have had a pre-existing condition. Mm-hmm. And I could never, my family could never afford health insurance. Under the ACA, that doesn't exist anymore.
Well,
that
in some places.
That's about a life.
In some places, pregnancy was considered a pre-existing condition. Now, think about that, you know?
But you see, but the beauty of it finally getting there, Obamacare, that's now the ACA, is that you can then remind people about the bad old days.
Sure.
You know, as if the bad old days ever worked for anyone. And we can move into the good old days.
Hi, this is Arnie. We're breaking into our hour-long interview with Eric Holder in order to go to a break. Of course, the interview continues, so stick around.
This is our life. And these are the times. We are the people, and the dream is alive. Give us the strength to be humble and kind, and respect one another, leaving no one behind. From the mountains and valleys that stretch to the sea, a brand new America is calling to me. I am filled with emotion as the flag is unfurled, a brand new America and a brand new world. Lord have mercy. We all have a story, and we all have a prayer. We all are equal, and God is fair. So lift up your voice and let freedom ring. Be eternally grateful for everything. From the mountains and valleys that stretch to the sea, a brand new America is calling to me. I am filled with emotion when the flag is unfurled, a brand new America and a brand new world.
All right, I got to change subjects. Since I've got you here, I just got to do this.
Okay.
I have a copy of a tweet.
Uh-oh.
And it's your tweet, Monsieur.
Uh-oh.
And here is your tweet. You know how I have to do this. Here is the tweet, and you will know where the conversation is going. AG Barr has deliberately misrepresented the Mueller report. He has started examinations of the conduct of the Intel FBI personnel without a predicate for political reasons. He is protecting the president. He does not stand up for the good people he leads. He is not fit to lead the DOJ, Eric Holder. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Opposite, see above, I'd say the same thing. What do we do?
Well, I'll first say that was a difficult statement to make.
I can imagine.
You know,
he has your position.
And I understand how tough that job is. Mm-hmm. And to criticize somebody when you know how tough the job is and all the things that he's undoubtedly going through. But I just thought that given all the things that I have detailed in that tweet, that it was incumbent upon me as, you know, a former attorney general with some degree of, you know, recognition to lend my voice and to let people know that what we're seeing is not normal. What we're seeing is inappropriate, and that Barr is simply not doing the job in the way that an attorney general is supposed to. You know, looking at the, you know, the intel community, looking at the FBI, and using the term spying. You know, I've been in the Department of Justice off and on since 1976. I have never used the term spying when you talk about court-authorized surveillance, whether it's electronic surveillance or from the FISA court. That is a loaded political term that he is using. And he's using that intentionally, not standing up for the people in the Justice Department who are Republicans, Democrats, liberals, you know, conservatives, and who basically put all that stuff aside to simply do their jobs. And yet he has, in essence, sided with you know, with President Trump when he orders this another investigation, in spite of the fact the inspector general is already looking at this question, orders another investigation. And then the way he mischaracterized the Mueller report, first in the statement that he that written statement that he put out, and then really kind of baffling to me, the press conference that he had where he mischaracterized the Mueller report, knowing that the report itself was going to be out in about 2.5 hours. And then you had the ability to look at the report and compare it to what he said. And he said, well, wait a minute, that's not true.
But, you know? But what's so scary is for the base, which is what this is all being done for, it sort of it frames the view so that now you go through his cracked lens. Mm-hmm. So now you see the report through that kind of strange lens, and therefore, even though you know the report says the opposite of what he says, because they are now given a different lens. I remember running for governor, and my press secretary happened to also be very good at video. Mm-hmm. And she's looking at the guy behind the camera, and she's looking at the lens, and she says, I want to get behind the lens. He goes, oh, no, it's fine, because he's got me a film. She goes, I want to get behind. He had an enhancer on the lens to distort my features. Oof. I'm running for governor, ladies and gentlemen. And this is what was – I mean, she knew. She called him on it. But understand, the audience would know that there was an enhancer on the lens. And it took somebody to see it, to take it off, so that they would see me, not what the image was. They wanted to distort of me. And that's exactly what Barr did. He distorted the image.
The way you talk about it, the enhancer of the lens.
Yes.
I mean, that first 4 or 5 page letter that he issued – that mischaracterized the Mueller report and talked about Mueller not making determinations on the basis of that OLC opinion that says you can't indict the president, totally belied by what is contained in the Mueller report. But that stayed out there for like 3-4 weeks, and that was the lens through which we reviewed the work of Bob Mueller until we saw the report, until we saw Bob Mueller in that short 10-minute press conference. But in a lot of people's minds, that what he did in that what Barr did in that 4-page, 5-page letter really set in stone for them what the Mueller report was all about.
Exactly. So that's going to make me segue to the next statement and the next conversation, and that is impeachment. And what you have just said to me is the foundation for why we need to move in that direction. And the reason is that there have been too many cracked lenses, too many enhancers. And in order to counteract that, because frankly, the problem with Barr and with Trump and with his administration is every single day we hear the enhancer. Every single day we hear the cracked lens. Mm-hmm. And what isn't really coming out in a consistent manner is the truth, you know, the facts. And I know that you can have sort of hearings, you can do something, but you and I both know that in a way that the term impeachment is an attractive nuisance. Everybody wants to watch. Everybody wants to listen. Mm-hmm. Good. That's what I want them to do. They're not going to listen to a hearing. They're not going – and even – I know the Senate will not support it, and maybe part of what we have to do is we have to have a dual track, saying understand – this is a Senate that basically has rubber-stamped everything. So do they want the facts out? No. Will they believe the facts or support the facts? No. But do you need the facts? This is not about the U.S. Senate. This is about the American people. And the result in the Senate is not what we're here for. What we want is for you to be informed. Mm-hmm. And I am just trying to figure out why that hasn't started yet. And I am worried that it's going to get too late. But I'm also worried that the knowledge that is in the Mueller report, the knowledge that the American people deserve, means that even as they move through the caucus process and the primary process, and even in New Hampshire, Bill Weld is running against Donald Trump. I think Every member of this country needs to hear this, whether they are a Fox listener or an MSNBC listener.
No, I agree with you. And, you know, I'm not at all certain. I'm not maybe at the point yet where I'd say we need to begin an impeachment inquiry only because of this. I think
I'm trying to figure out what it is. So
well,
tell me.
I think if we can have productive hearings where I am seeing Hope Hicks, where I'm seeing Don McGahn being asked the questions that would be asked in an impeachment inquiry, that is a fundamentally different thing than reading about them in the Mueller report.
I agree.
Get them on television. It's the same thing that you saw during I'm old enough to remember the Nixon impeachment. Everybody, kind of wants to relate this to the Clinton impeachment. I think the more relevant impeachment proceeding is the Nixon one.
Absolutely.
Where you saw the approval rating of Nixon being driven down day after day with those hearings when you saw people testify. And so I think that's what needs to happen. But the point you make is a good one, that time is somewhat of the essence.
Absolutely.
And so I need to see, a speed up of the number of witnesses who are called.
And I'm going to tell my Democrats, don't look at Clinton and the impeachment. No. Everybody cheats when it comes to sex. And it was all about sex. And the reason why the American people did not reject him is because too many people have had an affair, too many people have had a divorce, too many people carry baggage with them, and they saw him getting caught in the baggage and lying. Well, probably 98% of the people I know have probably lied at some point in time about doing something wrong with the relationship of someone they loved. Right. And they get it. So they were not wedded to the result of an impeachment because they could actually see themselves having made the same mistake and lied about it. The difference with Nixon and the difference with Trump is that nobody sees themselves in those shoes. Nobody is that corrupt. Nobody wants to cheat and steal like that. And therefore, their fear of what happened with Clinton is horse crap because it will not happen. Because this is a very different situation. It is more Nixon-like, but in some ways, it's more insidious than that.
Well,
because,
it is.
Oh, my, on a million times level. And I want everyone to feel totally understanding of it because I don't want them to trust me. I want them to hear it.
Yeah, I don't. You know, I say what I said about not being supportive at this point with regard to an impeachment inquiry. But I'd like to give, let's say, regular process an opportunity, but there is a relatively short period of time for that to occur, to bear fruit, to produce things. If it does not, then I think you've got to go to an impeachment inquiry because that enhances the power of the House of Representatives to use the courts to get material. Apparently, they've taken the decision on the executive branch that they're simply going to just stonewall. They're just not going to turn things over, which in and of itself, I think, is an impeachable offense.
Exactly.
What about just issue a contempt citation? Ask the court to issue a contempt citation for contempt of Congress.
Contempt citations, I think, right? And I don't understand, the dynamics.
They're subpoenaed?
Why is Hope Hicks appearing in a closed-door session?
Oh, God, don't get me started.
I think if you were going to call people, the American people need to see them. Even if it is just to see her come up there and say, I can't answer that question, or see the White House lawyer say, we're directing her not to answer that question. The American people need to see this.
Oh, my God. Right. In fact, I've been in settings where I have interviewed people on the radio, and they haven't answered the question, they've changed the subject, and I will mention the fact, well, you haven't answered the question, let's try that again.
Yeah.
Well, you haven't answered the question, let's try that again. And what they don't understand is they've just hurt themselves 1,000 times more than if they just answered the damn question. Mm-hmm. And what would have happened with Hope Hicks is that every time she refused to answer a question, people start looking at each other going, what's her problem?
Yeah, what's she hiding?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so she becomes the problem, not the fact that that we aren't getting the answer. Mm-hmm. And her non-answer speaks volumes. Yeah. And I think you're totally right. Just call me when you think it's time.
Okay.
One other thing, Eric, you mentioned Nixon's approval ratings went down, and I'm not looking to have Trump's approval ratings go down. That's not the goal. The goal is for the public to know what he has done and what he has said about what he has done and the lack of truth of what he has said. Knowing the facts is all that I think needs to come out instead of stonewalling the facts. And I'm hopeful that his approval ratings will go down when they see the kind of things that he has done that are un-American.
Well, I only mentioned the approval ratings to really kind of rebut the notion that this is a political loser, that people say, well, we can't do impeachment because the Senate will never convict and it will result in political losses for the Democrats. I'm not at all certain that that is the case. And beyond that, that shouldn't be
That's not a consideration. Do your job.
You have a responsibility under the Constitution, if you find impeachable offenses, to do something about that kind of conduct. And I actually think I'm not at all certain that it is the political loser that people. That's why I was talking about the approval ratings. Mm-hmm. And it would be an interesting thing. All right, let's just assume he's impeached in the House. It goes to the Senate. It will be interesting to see what some of these Republican senators who are in tough reelection races, what do they do? Right. What do they do? What does Susan Collins do? What does Cory Gardner do?
Right.
If they vote not to convict in the face of what I think will probably be pretty substantial evidence of wrongdoing, does that hurt their reelection effort? Or if they vote to convict, does that mean that a Republican then challenges them in a primary? You know, trying to predict the political consequences, mm-hmm. I think, mm-hmm. is just difficult, if not impossible. So just do your job.
Well, let's be honest here. This is actually Hope Hicks on steroids. So we wanted Hope Hicks to come in before the American people, not do it behind closed doors. And we want to see her not answer, divert attention, change the subject. I want to see that in the U.S. Senate. I want to see Republicans not answer, divert the subject. You know, I mean, I think people need to see this, because having seen all the testimony and having been able to hear it and process it in their own head, and then to see these people behave in such a way with knowledge that you have. You don't know what's happening with a piece of legislation. You don't have all the time and input. This is very different. It's very focused, and it's about someone you kind of know, Donald Trump. So in a lot of ways, I think everyone is playing the politics, which I think is the wrong thing to do, because I think the right thing to do is to move forward. But I think in the end, moving forward is also the right politics, yeah, in a good way. All right, last but not least.
Okay.
All right, reparations. Mm-hmm. So I've been thinking a lot about this, and we have been covering – we've been interviewing some of the most amazing people in the last couple of years. There was a book that we interviewed some guy on called The Color of Law, and it's really the story about how policy, mm-hmm. had such a harmful effect on African Americans, and it was intentional, mm-hmm. and it was something we wrote into the law. Whether it was policy dealing with after the GI Bill, it turned out all these things. So I'm kind of curious to get your response to this conversation, where that's finally bubbled up, had its first public hearing on reparations. And I just want to throw one idea out to you. As we're talking about reparations, I think one of the things I would demand, and I am not an African American, is I would want the history textbooks rewritten. I'd want them to reflect what happened. And I will use a word that I think is perfectly reflective of our history books. They've been whitewashed. Mm-hmm. And as you learn more of the real history of who we are, both our strengths and our weaknesses, you are shocked because of how much you were never taught. And I think that one of the best ways to have reparations is to make sure our textbooks truly teach what happened. And that will, I think, help to change the future, because it's based on our ignorance and our lack of knowledge or our lack of curiosity. And that would be one tiny little part of a reparations package that I would love to see happen. But I just wanted to plant that seed with you, because every time I learn something, I start to cry and say, I didn't know. How did I not know? And I think if we made it so that all of us knew, we would make much better decisions together.
Mm. Well, you know, this notion, first off, I mean, the thing that's being considered now is whether or not there will be a creation of a commission to examine the question of whether or not reparations should be given. And, you know, that seems to me, all right, why couldn't we have a commission just to get some scholars on it and kind of let's deal with the issue and see where we end up. Second, reparations does not mean we're going to write checks to people. You know, reparations can take a whole variety of forms, affirmative action, to deal with the lingering effects, not only of slavery. And this is something people need to understand. You know, it's not like in 1865 slavery ended and everything was just then great for African Americans for the next 100 years or so. Yeah. We went from, you know, slavery to an American apartheid system that systematically used the power of the state to terrorize African Americans, to keep them down economically, to keep them out of the political system. And so when Mitch McConnell says, well, you know, we're talking about trying to make me pay, people pay now for things that happened when we were never alive. Oh, yes, you were alive. You were alive, Mitch, when these things were happening under the Jim Crow system. You know, if you want to say it ended at all, if you want to be generous, you'd say it ended with the Civil Rights Legislation of 1964, Voting Rights Act of 1965. But I think you could even argue it goes beyond it.
Housing Act 1968.
Yeah, exactly.
But let's just say it ended there. Mitch, you were quite alive at that time, quite alive. And, you know, so dealing with the impact of slavery and the impact of that American apartheid system is one that as a society we have never grappled with. We are uncomfortable talking about issues of race. And if we're ever going to get a handle on the race problem that continues to confront us, we have got to have the courage to have a fulsome dialogue. You know, America is at its best, it seems to me, when we question ourselves. You know, when we question the ways in which we do things, when we improve things, you know, when we are just comfortable with the status quo, you know, that's not what makes this nation exceptional.
Did you pull your hair out when Mitch McConnell suggested that, well, you had a Barack Obama? Barack Obama. He was president.
What does that mean?
That it comes out of his mouth.
It could have been worse. He could have said, "You got LeBron James."
Yeah, I suppose so. But it's an interesting question because so many people. I mean, the Democratic Party is finally beginning to thread the needle because they were equally afraid of having the conversation. You know that, and I know that. And we just recently interviewed a guy from Demos about voting rights. And we know that there's been a move on the part of the Republicans to suppress the vote. And obviously people are concerned about that because, you know, who do they want to suppress and who do they want to make sure is denied access to the franchise? But Bernie Sanders was asked a question because of Vermont and Maine, the only two states in the nation that allow people who are currently in prison to exercise the franchise. And if you look at the legislative history that got us to this point, and I am so grateful to the attorney from Demos to actually put it down for us, it was intentional and it was focused on race.
Sure.
And I think, again, you know, you don't have time. Bernie doesn't have time to teach it during the course of a campaign. And Maine and Vermont are two kind of small little states in northern New England to explain that it hasn't really changed the whole nature of those two states because of it. But that's also an interesting way. A part of the reparations is to say, how do we restore the fact that we recognize their citizenship, therefore you never take away their right to vote? You can take away their freedoms. They can't walk outside. But there's something ingrained in citizenship that should never be taken away. And when you begin to realize that the rationale for this wasn't about the fact that there were bad people who'd done something wrong, it was a way of making sure that if you warehouse them, then that would be just one more segment that didn't get to vote in the course of some sort of conversation that you were having in Florida or whatever else. 5 minutes, okay.
Yeah, I mean, people need to understand, you know, that system was put in place after the Civil War, and when the freed slaves actually used the power that they had to send from Mississippi, for instance, a black man, Blanche Bruce, to be a senator in the United States Senate. Power structure down there said, oh, we're not going to let that happen.
Exactly.
We're not going to let that happen.
And bad experience.
We'll pass a law that's seemingly neutral on its face and says, you know, felons can't vote. Okay. And then we're going to make a whole bunch of African Americans felons.
Exactly.
And therefore, we will decrease their political power. There's a book I think I would urge everybody to look at. It's called Slavery by Another Name.
Yes.
By a guy named Doug.
Someone just sent it to me this morning.
Doug Blackman. Yeah. And he talks about not only the use of the state to suppress political power, but the use of the state power to, in essence, re-enslave African Americans. You know, you're convicted of a felony, and then prisoners are then leased out to private entities and, you know, worked to death. Now, it's interesting because when you have a person who is enslaved, that's property, and you want to make sure that that person lives as long as they can. When you're a person who is in the other system that Doug Blackman talks about, you're just a commodity, and you want to be worked as long as you can, and there's really no caring about how long that person lives. And they lived under horrific conditions, and it gets very personal. My wife, born and raised in Alabama, her sister was the one who integrated the University of Alabama when George Wallace stood in the schoolhouse door.
Oh.
Her uncle was picked up when he was a young man, and her uncle, Sharon's my wife, always said, uncle, you know, uncle was always kind of an odd guy. He was always kind of mad at the world. Well, it turned out we now understand that he was picked up and charged with vagrancy or something like that, made to be a felon, and had to serve time in a prison and then was lent out as labor, exploited, mistreated, and Uncle Henry. And he was a person who, you know, thought that was fundamentally unfair, and it ruined his life. It ruined his life.
I know. Well, and I was saying just today on the air that, you know, we're looking at sort of the whole question about legalizing marijuana. And I reminded everyone that now New Hampshire is the state that hasn't, and we're surrounded by states that have. I said, so you could perform an activity in New Hampshire and go to jail for something that if you were living across the border in Massachusetts would be perfectly legal. Now if you go to jail, you are now taking the franchise away. But if you lived in Massachusetts, not only could you do it, not only would you not be arrested, but you could vote. I'm like, ah, people, think about this. Mm-hmm. And I think in a lot of ways, my concern about my party and having fought my party for a long time sometimes is that we're almost afraid to talk to people about fairness and equity. And we know it's a hot-button issue and it's easy to demonize this issue or it's easy to be marginalized. Look at Michael Dukakis. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't find our voice. And I also think that there's something that's important, too, and that is that I was a fellow at Harvard, and I was given Bella Abzug's office. Mm-hmm. And I was so honored, okay? But there was a quote that I actually used in the course that I taught at Harvard. And I think it's important for both Republicans and Democrats to hear this. And the quote from Bella Abzug was, you have to lose, lose, lose to win. And I think that what we are learning, and we learned about it in New Hampshire with the repeal of the death penalty, we've been fighting that. We've been taking it to the legislature. We've been vetoed before by Democrats and Republicans. And yet, we won. Mm-hmm. We won. And I think that there's value in even a good loss because you've given the good talk.
But
and
here's
you build
the deal.
On the good talk.
I don't even think we have to lose.
Yeah.
I think that if we are authentic, if we stand up for democratic principles, Democratic Party principles, if we stand up for progressive principles, we will win. We will win. People like authenticity. People like strength. And if we exhibit strength in our beliefs, that I think will translate into electoral victories, especially given where progressives are coming from. We're coming up with, you know, measures that are going to benefit the people that take on the special interests. So don't try to compromise. Don't try to move to the right. Stand where you are. Fight for those values. Fight for those programs. You know, I'm a proud damn Democrat. I'm a proud person who traces his lineage back to, you know, Franklin Roosevelt, the New Deal. I'm proud of that. I'm proud to be a Democrat. Be proud of that. You know, you can call it socialism. You can call it whatever you want. You know, that's where I stand. That's who I am.
Well, I said the other day, so Mitch McConnell, sometimes he puts his foot in his mouth, actually a lot of times. So Mitch McConnell was talking about, like, you know, oh, giving statehood to Puerto Rico is socialism. Oh,
yeah, I tweeted about that.
Oh, you did too. And so I said, no, I have to thank him. And the reason is, so if every single thing that Democrats do is socialism, there is no socialism.
Right.
I mean, so in a way, he gave us a gift because this is how everything is a broad brush. But people don't live in broad brushes. People live lives. Yeah. And so and they know that, wait a minute, if that's socialism, I need that. No, it can't be socialism. And so this is what we do. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right about the fact that we should both be proud of who we are. But I also think people need to sort of get a sense that we're going to be courageous about it as well. Mm-hmm. And I think what Donald Trump has done is so elevated fear. That it frightens me, his fear. But that's more reason why I need to find my voice. Mm-hmm. That's more reason why I need to be courageous, because that's the only way you trump fear. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's been so exciting about the 2018 election was a couple of things that you saw lots of courage. And I'm also going to say something else. Is you are a proud Democrat, and I'm sometimes a confused one. But what I will tell you is that nobody knocked on a lot of those people's doors that decided to percolate up and run.
Right.
They ran because of courage. Mm-hmm. They ran because they saw a wrong that needed to be right. They ran because they knew that ultimately in a democracy, it's your responsibility, not only to exercise the franchise, but to vote. And I'm just hoping that as we move forward, that we truly are a big tent party and that recognize that the future and change is scary. But sometimes you need to be prepared to embrace it. And that's why I'm looking at this sort of 2020 candidates, this conga line of folks mm-hmm. that are running. And it's frightening because there are too many of them. And at the same time,
it's so incredibly exciting because I've never seen America on the stage before. And on Wednesday and Thursday, I'll see America.
You know, Dr. King said that the arc of the moral universe is long and it bends towards justice. Well, that's true to a point, but it only bends when people put their hands on that arc and pull it towards justice. Segregation didn't end on its own. Women didn't get the right to vote on their own, you know, just because it was the right thing to do. It's because people fought for it. And so I think we need to be more civically engaged, more civically involved. We have to have the courage that you described. We need to embrace the uncertainties of the future. You know, make America great again. That's a look back. And I always want to say to them, well, when exactly do you think America was great? Give me a year. Give me a decade. You know, America is at its best when it looks at the future, the uncertainties of that future, embraces it, and then turns it at our best to what are true American values.
So you have been do I have time?
No, I was just going to say in terms of it being politically fearsome to actually have a candidate that speaks up this way, I truly believe that it's not a hard sell at all, that most Americans, most human beings are good people. Yeah, we have our flaws and yeah, we have our blind spots sometimes, but we're good people. And if other good people speak out and raise their voices, as Arnie said, and be reasonable, not demonize people who disagree with you, not marginalize people that don't look like you, but let's talk about real things and how to treat our neighbors as ourselves, basically. To be a community of human beings that love each other and care about each other and lift up each other. And I think that political candidates who speak to the better part of America will actually be heard above the people that speak to the fear. Call out the fear mongers for what they're doing. But I think people will hear them. And I think some of the candidates are actually doing that. And it's a wonderful thing to see.
My father always said, don't get mad, be funny. Don't get mad, be funny. I was running for Congress in 1996, and I went into this very conservative space. And it was clear that they were out to get me. Mm-hmm. And so some guy came up to me, and he just basically said, I hate you. And he started going through this whole thing about welfare
reform. That's subtle.
I was very subtle. This is really the first way he introduced himself. And what I looked at him, and I smiled, and I said, have we met? And that's what I said to him. I didn't go, oh, my God. I looked at him because we hadn't met. Mm-hmm. And you have to meet me to hate me. Right. But if you haven't met me, then how do you hate me? And maybe after you meet me, maybe you won't be so afraid of me.
Well, you know, and that's actually one of the values of, you know, integration. We call it diversity, you know, but integration. It's hard to demonize somebody or hard to demonize a group of people that you know.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
That's why
we
did school desegregation cases.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. I've got 3 minutes left. I've got to ask you one question. Mm-hmm. So you've been an attorney general. You've had all these incredible. What was the best experience of your life in public life? If you could have to pick one thing that was sort of magical and you went, I knew I needed to be here for this.
To be the United States Attorney for the District of Columbia. It was a time. AG was great. I love that job.
Okay.
But being the U.S. Attorney in D.C., you're in essence both the local prosecutor as well as the federal prosecutor because of the unique status of D.C. At the time, I was a judge in Washington, D.C., and I was putting young black men in jail for inordinate amounts of time because of the, you know, sentencing guidelines and all of that stuff. I left it after 5 years, became the U.S. attorney in D.C., and tried to put in place programs that would deal with the underlying conditions that tend to breed crime and also to put in place criminal justice reform measures that would treat people more fairly in the system. The 5 years that I was U.S. attorney were the most enjoyable 5 years of my life because you also had you did things that you could see would have a direct impact, and you could see the results of those policies
actions having
relatively quickly because, again, I was only dealing with the District of Columbia as opposed to being AG. You put a policy in place, it's nationwide, you got to wait a couple of years to see if it works. I saw direct results, positive results from the work that I did as U.S. attorney.
Thank you. Thank you for spending an hour with us, more than I ever expected you to do.
Sure.
And in our little basement studio, I truly appreciate it. Eric Holder served as the 82nd Attorney General of the United States from 2009 to 2015 under President Barack Obama. He was the first African-American to hold the position of U.S. Attorney General. And you are the first U.S. Attorney General I have ever met.
All
so
right.
Thank you so much. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. We will see you tomorrow.